Lots of people head for the coast in the summertime. It's cooler, for one thing, unless you're engaging in strenuous physical activity. And we suspect there's at least some of that involved in archaeology field school, with students and professors from Southern Oregon convening by the coast to dig into the region's past. What are they looking for, and what are they finding? Well, those are among the questions we can ask to the two professors from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, generally referred to as SULA. Chelsea Rose, good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Glad to be here.
And Mark Tveskov is back here as well. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
So are you guys ever in a classroom?
Yes, we are quite a bit during the school year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But a lot of field work, generally.
That's right. That's right. It's one of the blessings of our job is we get to balance schoolwork and classwork and research at a computer with getting outside and getting some physical labor and finding interesting things in beautiful places.
So, Chelsea, tell us about the birth of archaeology field school and who takes part.
We've done these over the years. This is the biggest one we've ever done, and we had two projects on the coast that we really thought would be a good opportunity to bring in a bunch of students. So this is a partnership with the Oregon State Parks and Rec Department, who is partially funding this field school, and we're digging at the Geisel Monument State Heritage Site. And we have students enrolled from SOU, from California schools such as Berkeley and Humboldt State. We've got a student from
Minnesota,
and we also have a University of Oregon student. So we have a really nice blend of students from all over kind of coming together to check out some of our southwestern Oregon history.
And about how many people all together?
We're a big group. It's 21 people, which includes a film crew, and we're also incorporating the house program. We have a Skeptic House student when I teach in the Skeptic House here at Southern Oregon University, and we're filming a documentary while we do the excavation as well.
All right, so both you guys have film projects and have done a fair number of TV things. So it doesn't surprise me to find that there's a camera there. So
yeah.
And Skeptic House is what again?
Well, here at SOU, we have the house program where freshmen and sophomore students take their general education classes through the houses. And Skeptic House is one of them, and it's a program I teach in. And so we have one of our students there who has experience in the comm department here filming.
I was thinking that Skeptic House would be a good place for communications journalism students in particular.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
I can imagine. So before we get too much further along, I understand that there is actually some new news that you guys can report about the projects you're working on by the Oregon coast, and Chelsea's pointing at Mark for that.
That's right. Well, you know, we've been on this program. We love coming here and reporting on the work we've been doing, and we've talked about the Battle of Hungry Hill and Fort Lane, and those are all projects that relate to the Rogue River Wars, and we've been doing this now for over 10 years. And we've built a lot of partnerships with federal agencies, the state, and Western Oregon's Indian tribes. And we've worked together and applied for and now received a grant from the National Park Service to nominate all these sites to the National Register of Historic Places.
Really? Okay. Mm. So what do you have to do? This is a grant to do what then? What does the money go to do?
We're going to be able to investigate a couple more sites. We're hoping to do some excavation at the homestead of Mary Harris here in the Rogue Valley, which is a famous event in our history. And we're going to be able to do some additional work at the Battle of Big Bend site, which was the major battle that ended the Rogue River War. The Hungry Hill battle site started it. And then we're going to be able to interview tribal elders and do additional historic research and work with the state to nominate all these sites to the National Register of Historic Places.
Okay, so this gets back to when you mentioned tribal authorities and things like that too. There's a lot of moving pieces in these projects, Chelsea. It sounds like to make lots of different entities coming together to help you work on the digs.
Yeah, and this project has been I think why it's been so successful and so interesting is because it has truly been a collaborative project from the ground up, working with the tribes. They've been out there helping us do a lot of the on-the-ground stuff, working with University of Oregon has also been a partner in a lot of these projects as well, and then working with, you know, all sorts of historians and bringing in as many voices as we can, because the Rogue River War, this event, affected a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. So in able to tell that story, we need to kind of incorporate as many different perspectives as we can.
So these do include perspectives from the Confederated Tribes of Siletz. Is that right, Mark?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Robert Kenta, who's a historian with the Siletz tribe, is going to be giving a lecture in Gold Beach as part of our field school. And we've been doing that every Wednesday. And that's a good cross-section of the collaborative nature of our project. So I spoke the first Wednesday, and Ben Truey from the Southern Oregon Historical Society spoke last night or two nights ago. And Robert Kenta from Siletz will speak next week. And then our final speaker will be Patty Wehrat, who's a historian with the Confederated Tribes of Kusla, Rumkwa, Siuslaw, and she just published a book on ethnobotany, native uses of plants.
We had her on, yes.
Oh, great,
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patty, we're at Phillips, is it?
That's right.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Okay. We're talking to Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and the Archaeology Field School taking place in the summer with a couple of digs going on at the Oregon coast that we'll get into in just a few moments. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You may have questions. You may have some experiences with archaeological digs that we'd like to hear from you about. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. How much training goes on before anybody gets to pick up a shovel or a trowel or a brush or whatever your tools are at Archaeology Field School?
Well, that's the beauty of it. The students have taken archaeology classes, but this is their first time actually doing hands-on excavation, and there's no better teacher than actually doing the work that you want to do. So most of it is on-the-job training in the field here.
All right. They have to be taught a few procedures. I'm thinking about how to not, you know, take the big shovel and the pick and break the things that you're looking for.
And actually, a lot of people need to learn how to use a shovel properly. Even something as simple as that. You know, when you're working in digging under strenuous conditions for a long period of time, if you're not used to doing that kind of labor, and also archaeology requires a little bit of specialized tricks, but you know, it's literally starting from zero. But you know, everybody's having fun doing it. And, you know, we try to explain why we do different things along the way to keep it interesting.
So obviously it's exciting when you find things. But, I mean, there must be a pretty high ratio, I'm thinking of dirt that means pretty much nothing to you, two fragments found.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's a popular misconception that archaeology is an Indiana Jones adventure. Uh-huh. When the rhythm of it is more like fishing or gardening. It's with a bunch of people, and it's very steady and quiet, and you're in a beautiful place, and there are occasional rewards, and it has a nice steady rhythm to it.
I promised myself not to say Indiana Jones. I'm glad you brought it. But the question was about the way that movies make it look like you find big objects or tombs or jewels. Mm-hmm. Generally, how big are the objects you find?
Here, fairly small. We find tobacco pipes and musket balls and a variety of small things. The big things we find are the actual architectural features. So at Miner's Fort, for example, we're uncovering the tower that was in the corner of the fort, and that's a big feature, an immovable artifact. So actually, that's fairly large. And we're starting to uncover the walls of the cabins that were inside the fort.
All right, so the two places you're talking about here, Miner's Fort and the Geisel Homestead, about 4 miles apart, I think you said before, mm-hmm. the show, just north of Gold Beach.
That's right.
And so tell the story of each. What happened at the Geisel Homestead? This is a pretty pivotal story in Southern Oregon Native and settler relations.
That's right. So in the fall of 1855, Native people in the interior Rogue Valley here rose up in rebellion against American settler colonialism. And that winter, the war sort of percolated in the interior valley. And then in February of 1856, it spread to the coast, and the Tututni Native American people joined that rebellion. And on February 22nd, 1856, they attacked all the homesteads in Curry County, including the Geisel family's homestead. And do you want to say something about that?
Oh, yeah. And the Geisel family homestead was home to a German family. And one evening, there was a massacre there, and the men were killed in front of the women, and the women were captured and taken a couple miles upriver. And then they were held for 2 weeks, was it?
Something like that. And while the Geisel family was massacred and the women taken captive, the citizen militia there in Gold Beach, their leadership was killed in one fell blow from the Native American forces. It was a very coordinated attack, and all the surviving pioneers forted up at this fort they had been building, Miner's Fort, and they were mostly gold miners, and that's how it got its name. And there they were besieged. They were trapped in this fort for about a month waiting for rescue.
Had been building. Was the fort finished at the time?
No, it was partially. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the great things about this really pivotal moment in history, and we do have some documents about it, and they weren't there very long. So that means that anything we're finding in there, you know, that dates to this right period, we know exactly what events these artifacts are tied to. And that means that we can actually get some insight into the choices that people made as they fled their homes and retreated to this fort. And also once they were within the fort and they were cramped in there under pretty trying circumstances. And so this is kind of an insight into how they were interacting with each other and with the outside world during this period.
So what has happened at the sites of both the Geisel Homestead and the Miners' Fort in the years since they were occupied, since these events? I mean, has there been any occupancy there? Were things built on top of them, stuff like that?
They were not, and that's one of the great advantages of both these sites for archaeological study, because they haven't been built upon. And both of them have stayed in the local consciousness for a long time. The historian Stephen Dow Beckham wrote a famous book about the Rogue River War, and he frames the entire book around the experiences of the Geisel family. The book opens with that massacre. And Miners Fort, we've come to learn that folks in Gold Beach have long, long kept it in their memory, and they would have picnics out there, pioneer days out there, reenactments out there. And we even recently discovered that there was a woman from Gold Beach who would bake a cake in the shape of the fort and bring it to these pioneer picnics.
Really?
Yes.
So, of course, we're hoping for one of those hint, hint, if you're out there.
Yes.
So had there been some removal of stuff? I mean, I have to believe that both the homestead was burned down in this
Yes.
process, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Geisel Monument was impacted because the house was burned down with the men inside of it, and the remains of it were raked into a pile, and then it was marked with a cemetery stone, and that's still memorialized to this day. So we're digging around the fringes of that and finding the remains of the house on the outside. Christina Geisel and her daughter Mary, and her, when she eventually passed away, she was also interred with her first husband there at the Geisel Memorial. Miners Fort is a field. It's an agricultural field, and it has been picked over by artifact collectors over the years, but we're still finding intact architecture and many artifacts.
Archaeology Field School now underway on the Southern Oregon coast, just north of Gold Beach. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov are from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. You can join us on the exchange if you have some questions for them or some observations. Maybe you've found some artifacts at some sites over the years or have been interested in the process, and here's your chance to ask some questions about it. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Modern techniques and devices, I mean, just the stuff that you can do with your phone these days is pretty phenomenal. I wonder if there are great archaeology apps or something, or things that help you, or if you guys are out there playing Pokemon Go atop the Miners Fort.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Well, you are.
in this case, yeah, we have some amazing technology that we've brought to bear on this project. We're working with some geophysicists from Minnesota, David Mackey and Jeffrey Jones, and they came out to the site in March and used a magnetometer survey and a electrical resistivity survey, and basically took a picture of the entire fort under the ground without even digging, and that was a godsend. And we're able to see the outlines of the interior cabins and the walls and the bastions of the fort. And also we're able to re-identify survey markers set by local surveyor named Ron Newhouse back in the 1970s that marked the corners of the fort. And yep.
And this technology has been fantastic, because without it, we wouldn't have the map that we do today, because a lot of what this mapped was compaction differences. So, and it's mud. It was an earthen fort, so it's mud next to mud. And that's really tricky to see with the naked eye, but these machines could see that. And so now we can target our excavation and know we're within the north cabin, the corner, we're going to hit the wall here. And then, we can really map it in a very efficient way to get a good sample without impacting more of the site than we have to.
I remember similar discussions with the folks who were doing excavation at Fort Klamath, and they were talking about the density. You could tell by the compaction of the soil mm-hmm. where things stood at one time.
That's yeah. right.
Wow, that's pretty amazing stuff. Peter in Ashland dropped off a call, wants to know if there's any opportunity for high school kids to get an anthropology intro, or is this just for college students?
We do have a high school kid out there. This particular project, we have a lot of opportunities for the public to come check out what we're doing, and our next one is going to be on Sunday the 24th at the Geisel Monument State Heritage Site. And that is we're going to have a public day, and we have an open site public day where people can see the excavation, talk to the students, help out a little bit, maybe also see the artifacts we're finding and learn about what we're doing. We're also doing tours of the fort that day. We have public lectures every Wednesday. We've had two already, like Mark mentioned, and those are for the students, but we decided to open them up to the community as well so they can also learn what we're doing and get excited along with us. That's going to be the next two Wednesdays at the Curry County Fairgrounds at 6:30. In the future, we do like to provide opportunities for the public to get involved where possible, and we usually run those volunteer efforts through the Historical Society, the Southern Oregon Historical Society. So the next time we have some of those, that's a really great place to kind of check in.
With the work you're doing out there, and you mentioned that this is a place that was well known to the community with people having picnics out there and cakes over the years and stuff like that. But it seems like to pull the whole anthropological picture together, you're going to be doing a fair amount of work offsite as well. And I wonder if you get help from pictures of the picnics and things like that. I mean, lots of little tidbits of paper and pictures that people have kept over the years.
Yeah, for every hole we dig, we're also getting piles of documents, including letters that describe those picnics and the efforts of early surveyors in Curry County. And that's just as much of this project as actually digging holes, the written record and the oral record.
And when you're at the site, though, and you're finding little bits of stuff or, you know, places where the ground is compacted more than it was in others, I mean, is it almost like a pointer, like, hey, look over here, there's something else you might want to find, or is it a lot more puzzle, like putting puzzles together than that?
Yeah, and I think it is a big puzzle, and I think one of the things that all archaeologists enjoy is how these little bits and pieces invoke these very real human stories. Like here you had a bunch of people who were very desperate. Like they were living in a place where war was coming to their very doorsteps. I mean, this grant that we got from the National Park Service is usually used to analyze like Civil War battlefields or Revolutionary War battlefields where you had huge armies on the sides of two fields. This is a different kind of war. It's actually one we're more familiar with today, where the front lines were in people's houses. Like people were getting, like women and children were being killed and kidnapped. And the war started on the coast on President Washington's birthday. It was President's Day, and they were having a ball in Gold Beach, and that was interrupted. This festival was interrupted by this attack that killed dozens and dozens of people, and they had to flee in terror to this fort. And, you know, at Fort Lane, where we excavated, and their soldiers lived there for 3 years, you could see their daily life. You could see the food they ate in the form of animal bones and things like that. And their game, they had musical instruments. And, you know, this Fort Minor is very different. Like, we see almost none of that. All we see is this. I keep coming back to the word desperation. Somebody in the fort had a pile of lead movable type from an old newspaper. And one of the main activities we see is them melting lead into bullets to defend themselves. And they were taking this lead type and melting it into musket balls. And, you know, that to me, you know, the puzzle, like, that points to like the experience that they were having at that moment, which was, you know, pretty desperate.
Pretty harsh, taking what was on hand and turning it into something that could be useful to them. We're talking about Archaeology Field School with Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. You can join us. We'll take a few more minutes with them here on The Exchange. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Did anybody keep an accurate death toll, both sides, in the Indian
Wars?
We're
trying to figure that out with precision, but in the initial outbreak that night on February 22nd, it was at least two dozen people out of a population that was probably not more than 200. So the actual percentage of the civilian population, it was a lot of them. I don't want to give you an exact number. And then while they were trapped in the fort, they had a couple of engagements that they suffered very major casualties as a proportion of their population. There was about 100 of them in the fort, and they were hungry, and they tried to go out and forage for food. In a party, out of a party of 10, 8 of them were killed. Some folks in Port Orford tried to come down and meet them, and their boat turned over in the surf, and out of eight guys on the boat, 6 of them died. So they were suffering pretty major casualties proportionally to how many were there.
Wow, a lot of little side events that went on in addition to what you're finding on the landscape.
And in addition to some of this, you know, like Mark was talking about, the more practical survival side of this conflict, melting bullets literally to provide ammunition to defend yourselves, we also have these tokens of, you know, what people chose to essentially evacuate with. And we have a lot of heirlooms evident in jewelry. We have a lot of beads and some of this fine beads that would have been jewelry or, I don't know, clothing things. But then we also have these pressed glass dishes, like leaded glass, which is pre-Civil War. And these are heavy, these are cumbersome, and absolutely not practical. But what they reflect are the choices people made as they're fleeing. Like, what do they keep? And this would have been a very scary time, you know, in your way out in the frontier. And these are the symbols of home and your family and civilization, and they're bringing them with them. And, you know, that's been a really interesting thing to see. And it also reminds me of a few times, you know, we have fire danger here. We've had to, I personally have had to think about evacuating a few times. And what do I think about photo albums, art, nothing practical, right. You know, the things that are important to you. And again, you see this 150 years ago. Under, you know, very different circumstances.
Taking something other than your clothing and the stuff that actually would do you some good in the days ahead. Wow. How much do you guys get in the middle of disputes about how conflicts in the past are portrayed? I mean, people will probably object to terms like war, and you used the term colonization before. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody's going to get offended fairly easily, it seems like, in this day and time, and I wonder how much of that intrudes into the process of what you're doing at Sula.
I don't see it as an intrusion. I see it as a necessary part of the discussion. I mean, as professional archaeologists and historians, that's our job. Is to sort of think about and mediate those kinds of discussions. And looking back at the Rogue River War and how it's been portrayed over the years, it has changed. I mean, some of the essential facts have been known since the 1850s, but every generation tells a story slightly differently according to the political agenda that they had. And at the turn of the century, as the pioneer generation was becoming older, they wrote a lot of memoirs that very much whitewashed that story and took a lot of people out of the story. So, for example, in Miner's Fort, there was an African-American pioneer. And that's something we had to dig deep into these archives to find and see his experience here. And there were Native American women in the fort who were married to or common law wives to the white men. So, yeah, someone's going to be upset all the time. But this was a colonial situation. This was a cross-cultural conflict. And it wasn't easy for anybody. And, yeah.
Is there still some missing major piece, some site or artifact that you think exists and you just haven't found it? I mean, like, just sort of like you knew Hungry Hill was out there. You just didn't know exactly where it was and you found it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something else that you're still searching for, some holy grail in this whole process of figuring out what happened with the Rogue River Indian Wars? Is it a long list or a short one?
Yeah. Well, it's a long, you know, in truth, one of the big mysteries of the Rogue River War is not an archaeological one. It's a history. There was a Native American man named Enos who was a bit of a mystery. He's described as a Canadian Indian and of a mixed race Indian. And he was like a double agent. And he played both sides of the battle and became a Native American leader in that conflict. And after the war, he was captured and hung. But his identity is very interesting and mysterious. We don't know where he came from.
Okay. All kinds of great stuff out there going on at Archaeology Field School. Always a pleasure to visit with the folks from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, Mark Tveskov and Chelsea Rose. And you said Wednesdays are the public sessions at the fairgrounds in Gold Beach?
That's the lecture series. And Sunday, the 24th, from 10 to 2 at the Geisel Monument, you can come see what we're up to.
So are there signs to it as you come out of Gold Beach, going over the bridge, heading north on 101?
Well, the park is signed. Mm-hmm. And then we have a few, like, event ahead. But Geisel Monument's just a few miles north on the left-hand side.
Okay. Best of luck. Thanks for joining us.